Hello and welcome to today's podcast. It's our great pleasure today to have with us Carl Moriarty and John Roberts of RAFA. Founded by Simon Mottram in London in 2004, RAFA makes the world's finest cycling clothing. And for 15 years, their products have redefined comfort, performance and style for cyclists from absolute beginners through to world tour professionals. John, Carl, hello. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Debbie.
Hey, Debbie. Great to be here.
John, could you just give us a little insight into your role within the RAFA group, please?
Sure. So I've worked for RAFA for just over 2 years. My job title is Head of Product, and I'm essentially responsible for the product strategy and the direction of the product range and the commercial information or the commercials around the product range as well. So I create the product strategy and product briefs, essentially.
That's great. Thank you. Carl?
Yeah. So I'm the product design director. And so I oversee product design within RAFA, and then also material development, R&D, and our sample room.
Great. Thank you. And, of course, both keen cyclists. It's compulsory, isn't it?
Yes. It definitely makes life a lot easier.
Okay, thank you so much for your time today. Okay, we'll crack on with the first question. So when was RAFA founded and why was it founded?
What's so RAFA, story? As you pointed out earlier, it was founded in 2004, so 16 years ago by Simon Mottram. And essentially it was founded from a place of frustration, I guess, from a passion for a sport that was really underserved in the market. There was a real lack of innovation and desirability around product. And the sport itself was really misunderstood and underloved. Yet when you really dig into the sport, you know, to actually partake in it itself is massively rewarding and broad and really quite accessible once you get into it. But it's also full of really powerful, incredible stories and characters as well, which were really kind of not, these stories just weren't being told and these characters weren't really visible. I think RAFA has, you know, has always taken probably the harder way of doing things, but ultimately the more rewarding path. And it was launched completely different to anything else. It was launched with an exhibition called Kings of Pain. So it was an exhibition with photography, with stories about people within the sport, and a single product, which was a merino jersey. And this jersey itself, you know, relatively basic, but very, you know, very different to anything that was out there at the time, very premium. But yeah, it was a single product that quickly grew into a small collection of products over the next few seasons. And the business itself was quite difficult to get off the ground at the start. In 2004, it was quite unheard of to have a men's only premium cycling brand purely online. So this was a time when, you know, online shopping wasn't as widely used as it was now. So it took a lot of convincing to get a relatively small amount of investment, which inevitably came from quite a large pool of people to start off with. But yeah, that's kind of where it came from, I guess. And you can still really see that in the company now.
So the business started online. It didn't start with a store.
It started online, yeah.
That's great. That's good. Okay. And you have a very unique company culture, don't you?
I think a lot of great companies, you know, you walk in there, they do feel different to other companies. And I would say RAFA is, you know, it has got that about it. I'll never forget walking into the office and for the first time. it was about a year before I started at Rafa, and instantly I knew I wanted to work there. It was like, wow, there's other people like me in the world. There's other people that like cycling, weird Japanese brands. This is great. but it has got that thing about it. When you walk in there, it is very unique. And
quite
recently, and the people and culture team within Rafa have done a really good job of trying to articulate what makes our culture. And there's this kind of 14 pillars, which I won't go through all of them, but essentially, a lot of it is about loving the sport, and loving the things about the sport that make it really, really compelling. And there's still that culture of not taking the easy route, but taking the one that's going to get us to where we need to go. So we make a lot of really kind of bold decisions as well. And it's all subordinate to the passion for the sport and ultimately trying to grow the sport in the ways that we can affect.
Okay. So what do you attribute the growth of the cycling industry? And to combine two questions in one, really, what's the current size of the cycling industry? As you say, it's grown so much.
Yeah, definitely. So it's quite, it's always difficult to get exact figures, but where we've got to, the cycling apparel and footwear industry is worth around £6.5 to £7 billion.
Wow.
And that's from lots of sources of information, and around two-thirds of that is road cycling, around a third of it is mountain biking, and this is specifically apparel and footwear. People generally spend more on clothing within roads than they do in mountain biking, and there's lots of reasons within that, which we've kind of started looking into over the past couple of years as well, and found a real opportunity as well in the mountain biking space. But we tend to focus on, for our kind of customer, we're not necessarily the brand that people go to when they first get into cycling. So we're probably a second or third jersey purchase. We don't sell in too much wholesale, so still vast majority of our business is direct to consumer, and that won't change. And we don't sell our product in some of the big online retailers that a lot of people go to potentially for a first jersey purchase. So we tend to focus on highly engaged road cyclists, and that market is a lot smaller. So we estimate that to be just under £1 billion. But that's kind of, that's really where we kind of focus.
And why do you think it's grown so quickly? Why? I mean, it's such a huge sport now.
Yeah, I think there's lots of things. So there's quite big, if you look at commuting, for example, there's a lot more people choosing to get to work, especially in cities, on a bike, for various reasons, for overcrowding, not being able to drive or wanting to drive, not wanting to get on public transport. And essentially it's a lot more pleasant way of getting around, a city. But there's been a lot of big events as well. I think specifically in the UK, the Olympics in 2012 was a real big accelerator for cycling.
Right. Yeah.
The UK did really well. We had some big characters there, so big characters like Bradley Wiggins, who became kind of household names. And then there's more kind of high profile sponsors within the sport as well, so like Team Sky, who are, whether you're into cycling or not, a lot of people have heard of Team Sky and know about their ethos and how they've kind of transformed the sport for good or bad. But also, I think there's more and more brands now have kind of started to focus on cycling. And, a lot of that, I think, was what it was started by Rafa. There wasn't anything else there before. And Rafa have played a really key role, I think, in making the sport a lot more appealing and desirable to more people. And now there are countless versions of premium cycling brands that are kind of, yeah, that are doing the same thing or similar things.
That try to imitate, but yeah, you have such an established culture, don't you? And such established following to a very clear, yeah, defined, exactly, brand. Yeah.
Yeah. So we always try and stay ahead of the curve and try and reinvent ourselves and reinvent the sport to stay ahead of competition. We don't do that to stay ahead of competition, but I think the reason that's how we do stay ahead of competition is because we are
lead from the front with your kind of inherent creative culture, really. So you're constantly evolving, yeah, exactly, aren't you? Yeah, that's great. So speaking of, as we were before, of accelerating the growth of the apparel cycling marketplace, can we touch on sports performance? Carl, you probably have something to add here. And how sports textiles actually impact performance and how that has changed over the last few years?
Yeah, I think our primary focus has always been on comfort and how we can enhance comfort as an element of performance. And so it's a lot of focus on thermoregulation. How do we keep the body at the optimal temperature? And then on moisture management and how do we keep the humidity level at the optimum level, one for thermoregulation and then also just for general comfort. Unfortunately, it's really hard to change the dynamics of human physiology, and so we still have to work within those bounds. But I think we continue to find ways to enhance that. I think also on the competitive side of things, there's also the ability to affect aerodynamics. And cycling is a sport of marginal gains where as speeds and distances increase, these minor reductions in drag or fatigue can really have significant differences on the outcome of races and people's experience.
They're literally shaving seconds, really, but it's the difference between a win and a lose situation.
Yeah, I mean, over a 3-hour effort, if you can put in 0.5% less effort than somebody else or go, a percentage point faster, then that actually adds up and accumulates over those times and can make the difference.
Great. So tell me, Cole, how has the fiber composition of the textiles that you're using changed over the years?
I think the big thing we see right now is across the industry is a real focus on reducing the impact or the footprint of the raw materials going into products. And so we see a huge effort in refining the reliability and quality of recycled materials into the supply chain. And we see that across polyester and nylon. And then we're also seeing now a lot more bio-based polymers coming into commercial production. And again, helping us move away from a petroleum-based.
Yeah, huge developments there, aren't there? Lots of amazing things to arrive in the next couple of years when you can get the volumes to the acceptable volumes for you to go into production with them.
Yeah, and I think there's something around getting to an economy or to economies of scale and then also just getting to a consistency of quality. But there's definitely lots of interesting things going on there.
It's great. So you see sustainability being a huge part of your clients' requirements moving forward for the next, from now onwards, really, forever, becoming sustainable as a brand.
Yeah, I think that's just become the baseline now, and there's just an expectation that brands should be looking to contribute to a more sustainable industry because it's the right thing to do and because we should all be motivated to reduce our impact. And I mean, especially for us, the love of the sport we have is based in being outdoors and being in the environment, and we need moderate temperatures and clean air in order to be able to enjoy the sport. And as such, we have an obligation to do all that we can to make sure that we're not impacting in a negative way.
That's great. So do you try and continually improve the amount of transparency in your supply chain as well, so that you can drill right back to all of those core essentials as they move through the supply chain, so that you can trace
definitely.
The polyester and be as sustainable as possible?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that for us is based around relationships with our suppliers. As an organization, we've always taken the long road with our suppliers. We have a very stable supply chain and strong relationships with the companies that we work with. And so part of that is that it gives us really good visibility. And I think faith and confidence in our supply chain, so that we can see where we're making improvements, and we can also see where we need to make changes.
That's great. So it becomes more of a collaborative working relationship too.
Yeah, definitely.
Sharing of information and developments and new technologies for the future.
Yeah, definitely. I think we have a focus on choosing partners that we can collaborate with and that we can make long-term we can undertake long-term projects with.
So moving on to the next question, the rise of customization, without question, personalization, and how do you think that has redefined cycling apparel?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because club kit has always been a big part of cycling culture. And so I think in many ways the cycling industry has actually been ahead perhaps of other parts of the apparel industry. And this idea of being able to put together a custom design for small, medium, and large groups of people who like to ride together has existed for a long time, and there's always been business in catering to those clubs, and so what we see now is with advancements in data management and supply chain, we're able to get that number of or the minimum number of products down smaller and smaller.
So what's your minimum order? Is it 4 garments for a team? It's quite an incredible achievement that in such a supply chain, isn't it? To do that, you utilize various digital technologies, don't you?
Yeah, so we have an online design tool, which actually allows customers to go online and utilize the tool so that they can actually create their own designs onto templates from a large number of products that we make. And then we have a visualization tool which allows them to see how that design will come to life on the various products. And then we have a team working behind that to proof and check that the product will work. And then we have an 8-week turnaround where people can we can turn those designs around for people and have them out riding.
Incredible, isn't it? How simple it's becoming, or how simple it looks from the front end.
It's an amazing supply chain that runs behind that to be able to take designs from from all over the world. Into many different fabrics in different sizes, and to be able to get them through the system, sewn and delivered in 8 weeks, I think is an amazing achievement.
And the only way to do that, I guess, is to digitize that supply chain, isn't it? To digitize as many of those processes as possible.
Yeah, definitely. And the data management, I mean, I think the product visualization side of things is a big breakthrough in terms of giving people creative control and confidence in the design work and the product that they'll receive. And then the other part of that is obviously the data management side of it, in terms of how do you process the orders and how do you take those orders, bring them into the system, make them a commercial transaction, but then also make them a manufacturing transaction where that artwork can get laid out on the correct fabric and the correct patterns, be cut and then bundled into garments and then sewn together. And then end up being sent to the right place at the end of all of that. So
you're using a digital design workflow to do that very first start of that process then. So even when the client uses the customized portion of your portfolio of what you offer, that will then, that automatically goes into, I guess, a web to print system when they're using templates. So there's no need or requirement for any actual physical designer to touch those orders. Is that how it works?
Yes, but we do have a proofing process where someone with experience in the process does go through and proofs each individual design to make sure that that we are confident that the customer will be happy with the result. And that things will work. So there is still a human proofing process to ensure that we can stand behind the.
So when it comes to creating your John, you mentioned earlier that you're producing two seasonal collections a year. So when you come to working on the development of those projects. You're using a digital workflow again there to create simulations of products before you move over to approve them as almost as avatars, really, and 3D modeling before you then move over to making samples and twirls for production.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably more your world as well, isn't it, Carl, I guess? But yeah, we use a variation of different kind of prototypes, I guess, to make decisions on how products move through the gates. Yeah, Carl, you could probably talk in a bit more depth to that.
So pattern making in-house is done on a CAD system from Optitex, which allows us to... there's two elements to it. One is a flat pattern making, which allows us to create our base patterns and store them. And then we also have a 3D visualization tool, which allows us to stitch those patterns together virtually and then see how they fit onto various sized avatars so that we can check the fit of the product virtually before it's sewn. It's a relatively new stage for us, which we're exploring right now, but it has amazing potential for us to do stretch analysis and refine the fit process.
So that using the Optitex software as well, of course, you can actually really fine tune that stretch and everything, can't you, by giving the parameters of the absolute parameters of that fabric and its performance, its weight, how it's going to move, where it's going to see tension, where you need to adjust fit. You can actually really fine tune all of those quantities, can't you?
Yeah, definitely. It has. Yeah, it's a great analysis tool which allows you to see how much tension a fabric is under in certain parts of the garment, and also suit certain ranges of movement. So we can move people in and out of their riding position or from a relaxed riding position into a more aggressive riding position, and we can see how that changes the tension in the fabric across the body. And then from there, just allows us to really refine the fit of the garments.
So once you've created all of those files, then John, maybe this is a question for you. How have you adapted the manufacturing workflow so that you take those digital files and then move them through your production environments? Do they remain totally digital, or do you split the supply chain depending on different quantities, different variables?
I'm going to take that one again, I guess.
I'll try harder next time, John.
Digital file management, we share our files through a DFX format with the majority of our production partners. The production cutting varies by factory to factory, and so some factories would still be hand cutting, in which case the files would be printed, and then the paper plans, paper patterns laid out over the fabric before cutting. But then the majority would be CAD cutting, and so those files would go through a marker maker to lay out the yield and the exact cutting or lay plan, and then they would be digitally cut.
So production is as efficient as it could possibly be, which is great. So you're saving fabric, you're saving time, you're saving ink, you're saving precious resources in every area, and by controlling design right at the very beginning, you really are eliminating as much waste as possible out of the whole cycle. Which is
I think one of the biggest advantages is the ability to be able to send patterns back and forth instantly from the sample rooms with our manufacturers to our sample room in London, and so we can make small adjustments to the patterns and send them back instantaneously, and then vice versa when changes are made at production, we're able to see those changes and then verify them before we make commitments to change and to move into production.
Fabulous. It's amazing, isn't it, how much technology can readjust the whole supply chain incrementally.
And yet things can still go wrong.
Things will always still go wrong, won't they? But we learn from those mistakes, hopefully, and we don't do that again. But no, things will always go wrong in production. But there's no manufacturer that's perfect, is there? So
there's no system that's perfect.
No, there isn't, but we can keep fine-tuning. Carl, thank you so much for your answer there. John, I think I do have a question for you. So, John, tell us, thank you so much for your questions on production and design, Carl. John, power of community. Can you tell us why you founded the Rafa Cycling Club and the Rafa Foundation and give us a bit of insight into what those are?
Sure.
Is that a good question for you?
It is.
Good.
Thank you. our kind of vision as a company, or our purpose as a company, is to make cycling the most popular sport in the world. That's what we believe and that's what we want to achieve. And a key part of that, I'll talk about Rafa Cycling Club first. I think a key part of that is our product, and through our product, our aim is to create the ultimate riding experience. So we want whoever buys Rafa products, they buy it because they want the best experience, and our product will provide that experience for our customers. And within our Rafa Cycling Club, we really want to kind of curate that whole experience, and we do that across content. We do it through community, so organized rides. You get access to a lot of to our app, where you can kind of meet like-minded people, organize rides with fellow members of the RCC, go into our clubhouses where you get free reduced price coffee and other incentives. And then from a product perspective, we offer products that you can only buy through being a member as well. So we call it the world's best club kit. So we make club kit. We've got our own Viz ID, and you can buy ClubKit, but we also do lots of collaborations with various different brands, like coffee machines, for example. You know, coffee is such a big part of of cycling culture. So real kind of specific things that really kind of curate that whole cycling experience for our best customers and people that want to be really kind of closer to our brand. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's a really, really important part of our business model. And the RAFA Foundation as well, I guess, you know, just tying it back to that broader vision and that broader purpose for our brand. You know, we do genuinely believe that cycling isn't anywhere near as popular as it should be, and we all genuinely believe like in the benefits and rewards you get from cycling, and whatever, you know, what better way to do that than to grow the sport itself. So we're in a, you know, really kind of fortunate position to be able to donate a large sum of money every year into grassroots foundations that are really there doing good for the sport and are genuinely growing the sport. As an example, one of our first beneficiaries were quite a small organization in New York called StarTAC Cycling. And, you know, a couple of guys had ran this small club, and they're getting kids off the street into cycling, into track cycling. And they started off with a couple of kids doing it. Now there's hundreds of kids turn up every week. Wow. They got like an outdoor velodrome that was just falling apart. So we donated, you know, some of the money to them, and they're able to maintain the velodrome and keep it running. So there's lots of small organizations like this around the world. They're genuinely doing really good and genuinely getting a lot more people out on their bikes. And it's there to support those organizations.
That's fantastic. And
there's lots more interesting stuff coming there as well. You know, something that's really exciting and just something that really kind of ties us back up to our bigger purpose and what we want to achieve through cycling.
Building those foundations, like you say, building the future generations as well, really, with a love of sport and keeping them healthy and fit at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in all exactly. Areas of their lives, from just, you know, physical fitness to mental fitness, it goes across the whole board, doesn't it? It's great.
Yeah.
Really very, very
important. Absolutely.
Guys, that's great. Thank you so much for your fabulous answers today. I can't let either of you go. I've been asked to ask you this question. So can both of you tell us which is your favourite ride? It can be anywhere, and why? UK or abroad?
I'll let you go first.
Go on. What would it be?
Well, okay, for me, there is a mountain bike trail that runs across the Sunshine Coast in British Columbia, and okay. It's called Highway 102.
Guys, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you both. I'll make sure that all your contact details are in the podcast notes, and we very much look forward to speaking to you again soon and following the RAFA journey. Thank you.